I just had her on a little while ago on a show, Faye Houston. And Faye, we talked about her health and issues that she found some answers to. And she also wrote another book, and she sent it to me. She was nice enough to send it to me. And Fanchon's Daughter is the story of the woman, well, a woman and family and a lot of people, but the woman who adopted her. And she didn't think I was going to be interested in it, because she thought, TJ's just probably into the ghost stuff or the paranormal. That's not true. I love history, and I love reading about other people's stories. You can gain so much insight from people's stories if we all just shared that, because like we used to, probably generations ago, people shared stories. So Faye Houston, it's awesome that you're back with me. Thank you for joining me.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
So this was your second book that you wrote?
No, this was the first one.
This was the first one.
Yes.
Invisible Enemy was your second one.
It was, and that one is topical now, too. Maybe some other time we can talk about it, because it's all about when I was ill with pesticide poisoning.
Right.
And what chemicals in our environment do to our bodies, which, of course, is a top subject right now, with the EPA deciding to regulate chemicals, but we can go into that some other time.
I know that's a passion of yours. I can just hear your voice lifting, and you know what? Mine as well, because I've talked to so many people. You and I have talked, even when we weren't doing the interview, about natural items that are out there that can truly heal us and help us. And I just did a show with a fella out of Florida who talked about some natural. So I'm open to all of that stuff, and I really believe that some of it's being suppressed. But that's probably for another show. Maybe the spirits can help us with that one, too. Maybe they can say, and pass it through. But we're going to talk about your book, which I just, again, I love this book. I picked it up. I started reading. I said, this is fascinating. This is fascinating. It's a different lifetime. And also, you had lived a different lifestyle compared to probably what most people did during the Depression, but Fanchon's Daughter is the story of your adoptive mother and your family and everybody. So tell us a little bit about let's get started with Fanchon. She's an amazing woman, wasn't she?
She was an extraordinary woman. And the older I grow, the more I appreciate her. She was extraordinary not only in her capacity for love, which I wish every child could have had a mother like mine. She was also extraordinary in the career that she carved out for herself, because she came from very, not very poor, but poor people, and she had to make her own way in the world, and she and her brother formed a theatrical producing team, which became so famous in the 1920s and 30s. They were known as Fanchon and Marco, and they produced these small 40-minute miniature musical comedies, which they packaged and sent out on the road to appear in the cinema theaters all over the country, and they were at one time described as the Henry Fords of show business, because they produced these things on a sort of regular basis, but she was remarkable. She was the creative inspiration for everything. Her brother, they were very close, and he took care of all the business side, but my mother was the inspiration, the creative inspiration, and she had such energy and so many ideas, and she sometimes almost overwhelmed me because she was such a powerful person. But she was a wonderful, wonderful woman.
You know, as I was reading it, I was thinking, you know, I like to look at different parts of history, and I love learning about it, and I had never heard of this woman. And, well, maybe I don't follow Hollywood era or what would, you know, the vaudeville things that took place. But it's nice to find out about somebody that had such a huge impact in so many people's lives back then, and was probably a common name. But yet today we've forgotten about that person, haven't we?
Yes, we have. I don't think the name was very common. There are people called Fanchon now.
But I'm just saying what she did, she was pretty well known for.
Oh, well, what she did at that epoch, she was very well known for, and especially, you know, in New York and Hollywood, because that's where most of her work was done. But, yes, generations forget. You know, they don't know what happened before. But her work is all of the memorabilia of my mother's career is in the Huntington Library in California.
Wow.
They have a whole section there with the pictures. My whole family, myself and my cousins and my brother, we all contributed all of the memorabilia that Mother had, our scrapbooks and the newspaper write-ups. So they have a whole thing there, and it's used by historians who want to know more about that period and the dance and theater and all of that. So it's preserved.
It's cool because, you know, and I'm not saying we need to hold on to our history and glorify it as much, but, you know, that's how we learn not to repeat some of the things from the past. But also it's kind of the pioneers that you know, your mother was one of the first, if not the first, woman producer. That to me is probably bigger than anything, that she was in a time when women were suppressed a lot, weren't they?
Yes, well, they found life, it wasn't as easy for them to get ahead in, especially in the theatrical world, as men, but she was just remarkable. She didn't recognize any obstacles. She just felt that if you worked hard and you had a vision and you created it, that it would be accepted, and she was right. It worked for her because she had that outlook on life, I think. She was very optimistic.
It's almost like she had faith. It's like she knew.
Oh, yes. Well, I think my mother was a very dedicated Christian Scientist, and it was very odd because she was Jewish, but she had converted.
That's a little...
Well, my whole background is very odd because I'm half Jewish.
Yeah, good for you.
So I was adopted by Jewish parents and raised in the Christian Science faith, which in itself is a bit bizarre. But I also grew up as a very dedicated Christian Scientist, and I only left the church when I almost died trying to heal myself. But that came later in my life. But Mother was a very positive person, and Christian Science is a sunny faith. I'm very glad that I was raised that way, except that I'm also glad I had a very healthy constitution so that I didn't need to go and see a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
But my father was not. He would have seen to it that I... Well, in fact, I did have an accident, and I was taken to the hospital, and he gave me all the medical care that I needed. And so it's... Well, that's another subject I don't
right.
want to get to.
You know, and I look at the balance of your parents, and these are your adoptive parents in this book. And this really is about adoption, and that's what. And I love the fact that we're going to get into this because I have friends that have been adopted or have given up somebody for adoption. And this is, you know, a lot of times it's not talked about, and maybe light needs to be shed on it with respect to everybody involved. And so it's kind of cool that you're sharing your journey, and many people have done this, I'm sure, but you're sharing your journey. First of all, you're telling this wonderful story, and then you're sharing this journey, which you eventually take, almost reluctantly at some point, times it seems like, to find your parents, your real parents. And part of the reason you didn't want to do that was because you were pretty happy with the way things were, right?
Oh, yes. It never occurred to me growing up that I would ever search for my birth parents. I did. First of all, I thought it was impossible, and I had no need to because I had a very favored life. I'm very aware that I was privileged, and so I had no reason to. And it was only when my 40s that I suddenly thought, you know, began to wonder for various reasons. But I've read many books written by adoptees about adoptees who have searched for their birth parents and found them. And I noticed that all of them focus really on the birth parent, the birth mother mostly. And I thought, well, the adoptive parents don't get much of a look in. And I think it wasn't until I became an adoptive mother myself that I began to think, why aren't the adoptive parents and what they experience, why aren't they written about more? So mm-hmm. That's partly what made me want to start writing it, and the other part was that I gradually began to feel a need to find my adoptive father, not my birth mother. I mean, I was curious about her, but I didn't have any need to find her, but I had a rather rocky relationship with my adoptive father, who was a diamond in the rough, but a diamond above all. And I mean, he was a wonderful father, but he had a bad temper, and
now,
that made me
I'm sorry.
Difficult.
He was a successful man in his own right because he had like a restaurant, and he didn't he start like some of the drive-in restaurants out in California?
Oh, yes. Well, he had several restaurants and several drive-in restaurants when they were becoming popular. And, no, he was a very successful restaurateur and a very successful businessman and a good man. He just was born with this difficult temperament. And some people inherit, I think, difficult dispositions, which they can't do much about. But it didn't affect his character. He was he was a wonderful man.
You know, and I look at it too, like it's the generation too. You got to look at the generation. My father was like this, and he was born in a time when the men were right, and especially the children. You never challenged the adult on their authority. Even when you became an adult, you still weren't supposed to do that. I don't know if that's some of what Bill was like, your adopted father.
Yes. Well, he was a very staunch Republican, and I wasn't. I mean, I actually became a Democrat when I got old enough to know what was going on. I'm now nothing. I'm an independent in mm-hmm. every sense of the word. But we had many clashes. In fact, my editor had made me take out one chapter which faithfully recorded one of our worst incidents about politics. That was in the McCarthy era, and I was very much against McCarthy, and it was a difficult time. I was estranged from him for several months because of that. And but you know, these things happen, and certainly that era, bad as it was with McCarthy, doesn't seem like anything as bad as what we've got now. I don't want to get into that, but I just would never believe what's happening now.
I know.
But there we are.
We are going through a great change. That's what I see. It's we're going to have some ugly things happen before the good things, I believe are going to happen. So things are going to come out. The truth is going to come out in every which way, and some of it's going to be ugly. But what I found reading your book, which I recommend to anybody, even if you're not dealing with adoption or you know somebody, it's just a great story, and your dad is made real. Your adoptive dad, he's made very real because he's not perfect, and nobody is, right? And you present that in a way that maybe at one point you resented him, but I think, you know, your viewpoint changed on that as you got older. And you bit your tongue probably many times, didn't you?
Oh, yes, many times. Not too many times, because if I bit my tongue, we wouldn't have had so many arguments.
Okay. Yeah, I remember.
But anyway, I don't want to focus on him.
I understand. I'm just painting a picture a little bit. So you had a really great adoptive parents and a really great life. And then at some point, was it your brother? You're also your adopted brother. That's what kind of led you to maybe think about do that as well a little bit?
Yes, partly because he did search for his birth parents years before I did, or before I even thought I would. But you know, what I think I'd like to say about this is, yes, I had a wonderful life and all that, but I think the need I felt, or the impetus to try to find my birth father, was, I always thought it was because I wanted to find out who I was, which I did, and find my father if he was still alive. But I think what impelled me on that, I was meant to discover that, how can I put this? I was meant to be led to Ina Twigg. That's what I want to say. I wish every person in the world who has lost someone they love could have had the experience I had, which proved to me beyond doubt that there is no death. Mm-hmm. It is just a temporary separation, a passing. Ina Twigg, I should explain for your listeners, was this remarkable, I mean, she was a very famous, she's not with us anymore, a very famous medium in London. She was known all over the world. She would receive letters and things from people who wanted her to help them with whatever their grief was. And I didn't go to her for that. I was very skeptical, but a friend of mine, I told a friend that I wanted to find my birth father as soon as possible, and he was involved in the paranormal and all of this psychic thing, which I sort of didn't want anything to do with. He said, you must see Ina Twigg. So I went to see her. I had never been to a medium before, and I was very cautious. She didn't ask me any questions. She didn't want to know why I was there, and I had no intention of telling her. So I was just a friend of someone she knew, and that sitting with Ina changed my life. I didn't realize it completely at the time, but it did.
So you went from being pretty much a non-believer, right? You weren't open to this pretty much at all?
Well, I wasn't closed to it, but even though I think if you have been very religious, even though I'd left the church by then, going to a medium seemed to me slightly, it wasn't done. And but I was also curious. I'm intensely curious about new experiences, so I thought this is going to be interesting, but I was very suspicious. I thought, she's going to feed me a lot of stuff I already know, and she's going to pump me. And well, she didn't do any of that. I can't go into the whole thing, but the main thing was she didn't know why I was there. I knew nothing about my birth parents. I had just found my original birth certificate, so all I knew was their names and their ages when I was born. They were both 23. I knew nothing else about them, and that's what propelled me to try to find out more. And she started to, there's much more to it than this, but she started by telling me that my father, she said, your father is on the other side, which I knew meant he was dead. And I didn't want him to be dead. I wanted him to be alive. I wanted desperately to meet him. But of course, my adoptive father was still alive, so I knew she couldn't be talking about him. And I thought, this isn't going to be true. I'm going to find him and she'll be wrong. And then she told me, too, that as she went on, that she was being overwhelmed by the smell of alcohol, that someone on my father's side must have been a heavy drinker. And I thought, that can't be Daddy, because he wouldn't allow alcohol in the house. He was very much opposed to it. Mm-hmm. And we didn't drink or smoke in my family. And then she went on to say that my father felt enormous remorse for what he had done to Sarah. And Sarah was the name of my birth mother. So I knew this could only mean my birth father, and I didn't want any of it to be true, which finally made it all the more authentic. So I had hired someone, an agency man, to find my father for me in California, because I lived in England and I couldn't do the search myself. And 4 months later, I received his report, and he said everything she said was true. My father had died a year before I started to search for him. He had been an alcoholic, had lived in a home for alcoholics, and as I later found out when I went to California and met some ex-alcoholics who knew my father very well, he had been filled with remorse. They didn't know if it was for Sarah or not, because apparently you don't talk about your private life.
Right.
But they said he acted as though he was just filled with remorse. So how can that not prove the soul's survival? Because there was no way. I mean, she couldn't have got it through telepathy out of my mind, because it wasn't in my mind.
Right, that's a good point.
And I do wish that to me was almost one of the most foolproof proofs that there is this continuity of life in a different form. I mean, there's a lot I don't know about it, but I know that my mother is very glad that I finally wrote about her, because she once asked me if I would write about her career, and I wasn't interested. I wasn't interested in that at all. I had all the arrogance of youth. And now I know she's happy that I have, and I know I'm going to see her again. And I will meet my father, my birth father, but that's not so important. I'm just glad that my mother knows that she's not completely forgotten.
No, I think that's, and the way, you know, the way you wrote it too is, I just think you read it about your mother talking about Fanchon and how extraordinary of a life she was leading, which all of us truly could if we maybe, you know, push ourselves to that point. So that is just a great thing to share with people. All the things she did, all the people she knew, all the connections she had, and also how giving of a person she was. That's probably more important than anything, how much she cared about you and loved you. That's, I just loved it. The whole story was really fascinating. And it was very honest. It felt like at times, you know, there were hard things that you had to admit, which, again, that's awesome that you went that route. Some people might sugarcoat it or say it in another way. And I like honesty. I like transparency. That's, again, what made me really like your book. You talk about Ina Twigg, and she certainly sounded like a very amazing psychic. And I've worked with a lot of people, that some of which I think are very good and some of which maybe need to improve and get better. They do. They can get their skills better if they desire, just like any one of us here can probably become a little bit psychic and develop those skills too. But what you said, what she told you in that book, what I was reading, very similar to what I've experienced when I've worked with people or gone to people that I felt were pretty good at what they do. So this is corroboration for me as well, because it's like I've worked with a lot of psychics over the years, and they say very similar things, and they explain it in a way that Ina in this book was talking about it. And it's cool to know that we go on, isn't it? That it's just not a big lump of coal when we pass away.
Oh, no. There's so much more to life and death than we imagine. And I just feel it's, I've been so fortunate to be given this gift of this experience, because I have this joy. I hate to say I'm looking forward to death, because I'm not looking forward to dying.
Right.
But to the life beyond, Ina said, death is just the end of a chapter, but not of the book.
Yes.
And she was so right.
Mm-hmm.
This is just one chapter, and there are many more to come.
Yes. And what do you think, in your own speculation, just for the fun of it, what do you think happens when we get done with this lifetime?
I don't really think I can speculate. All I know is that the essence of what we are, who we are, the essence of who I am, goes on, I hope, in another form. I would love to be rid of the body. I think that would be just wonderful to just drop. You know, the Hindus have a wonderful expression. They describe death as dropping the body. Isn't that a lovely image? And I would just love to, I've often thought I would love to be able to just unzip my body and step out of it and then go on to the next life when the time comes.
That is just, it makes you feel good, doesn't it, to know. And I don't have any fear. You know, if today's my last day, it's like I know, because like I told you before, both my parents have come to visit me. And my father also went to visit my brother. And it was very clear. And I don't think I told you the story about my father, but he laid next to my brother. This happened in 2003. So it wasn't that long ago. And my brother, like you had with your father, there was some tension, you know. I never felt that way after my dad passed. I had nothing but love for him. But as far as my brother, there was some issues there. And I think that's when my dad went and he laid on his shoulder. And, you know, it's kind of an awkward thing for guys to do that. As far as women, probably not a big deal. But if another man, especially your father... Maybe when you're a little kid, it's okay. But if you're a grown adult, and dad wants to lay it on your shoulder, I wouldn't have a problem now because I'm pretty much at peace with all that stuff. But there's a certain time in my life where that would have been awkward. Awkward.
Was that at the moment of death?
This was well after. He died in 96. No, he died in 84. It was almost 20 years later in 2003.
Really?
That he came to my brother. Well, he came to me in 96, 12 years later. But he came to my brother in 2003, and my brother's half asleep, not sure if it's a dream or not. And my dad's laying on his shoulder talking to him. And he said, you know, it wasn't really weird. He says, now that I think about it, and they're just having this really heartfelt conversation. And that he said, instead of waking up from this dream, the room got lighter. And dad just faded away. And the reason that dad laid on his shoulder, because there's always a reason when spirit contacts us, they will always try to prove that they've been there. He could feel for 10 minutes afterwards, you know how when somebody lays on your arm or your shoulder, he could feel that.
Yes.
So it was proof to say, I was there. Hello.
Yes.
You don't believe me? I'll prove it to you. And I think my dad, for maybe some of the things he did in life, was trying to make peace. I don't know if you need that to move on or if it's just something he chose to do, but it sure seemed that way. He was doing that with me and both my brother. And I don't know if you have have you felt like you've had any visitations from anybody?
I'm sure I've had them from my mother. Not in that way. I mean, I've had no physical contact in that respect, but actually it would take too long to describe now, but I've had electrical things happen, partly one in particular to warn me about someone, and it was only when I finally broke off with this woman friend, who I thought was a friend, but I later found out was not at all. And later, after I broke off with her, these electrical anomalies didn't happen anymore. I was having my fire alarm, and I never fry food. I'm a vegetarian, but my the fire alarm in the house. You don't call it the fire alarm. What am I? I've got the name wrong.
Right, the smoke detector.
The smoke detector. That's it. That it would keep going off at odd times, and I had an electrician come and look at it. I had the man who installed it come and look at it. I changed it and got a new one, and it would go off at 2 a.m. or 3, for no reason, absolutely no reason. And I began to feel this was my mother warning me about something, but I didn't know what. Until it happened that an incident occurred and I suddenly saw this person for who she was and then broke it off, and then that was the end. Never happened again.
Yeah, isn't that something?
So, I mean, it couldn't have just been a coincidence. That I just felt it was my mother. And another couple of times something like that happened. So you never know. It's you just know that they're there, or I feel her presence. Or sometimes when I'm walking, I will get this. I'm walking outside and suddenly a tremendous sense of perfume will come, and I'll look around for flowers or something, and there's nothing there. It just hits me all of a sudden to say,
right.
Yes, I'm here. And she did love perfume, which I don't, so it had to be her.
Well, and I've heard that so many times, and even recently I've heard it from people I know. There's a friend of mine, he works at now there's no way in heck that this is going to happen. Maybe there's you could look and say, well, maybe you were walking by flowers or there was a scent in the air. There's a friend of mine who works in a garage. Now, garage doesn't smell so good, garage, if you've been in it. I don't mind the smell of a garage, but I'm just saying, you smell oil, gasoline, whatever.
Yeah.
His mother died about a year ago. He's been going through some tough things, and twice now, in a very short period of time, he has smelled her perfume in the garage, where it's only a bunch of sweaty, hairy guys. So it's like, and then he saw these eagles, too. And, sometimes animals will back up to spirit. Sometimes you'll get a visitation, an animal that will show up in a place where you never expected. And this has happened to me many times and other people. Have you had that happen?
Oh, yes. I think I mentioned one in my book where I felt led by this bird that flew in front of my car and on a very busy street. It was right in front of the hood. Do you call it the hood or the bonnet? The hood. And it was weaving back and forth, and as it was guiding me. This was the day I went to find out about my birth parents at the children's home where I was adopted. And I felt it was guiding me. And then just before I reached the corner where I was to turn into the street, it flew up and across the street and came to land on a house across the way. And I absolutely felt that it had been saying, yes, I'm guiding you. And then, of course, that was the beginning of my journey, my search.
Yeah, I remember reading that now that you mentioned it. That was really cool, that story about the bird. And that's happened to me, and it's happened to people I know. And so it just all ties together. It's funny how, there are people. You would think that maybe they go to a psychic school and they all say the same things, because much of what they say is very similar. And much of what they believe is very similar. And how do they come to that conclusion? And I think a lot of them just know this. They tap into something and they know it. So in your book, you do eventually discover that your real father has passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And then you do find out about your mother. And Ina, that's her name, right? Ina Twigg?
Yes. Ina. Funny name, Ina, yes.
But
she was a lady.
I'm sorry, but I remember her mentioning something about the name Sally, right?
Yes, well, Sally, I should explain. Sarah, when I finally got in touch with her, she said she's called Sally. She didn't use Sarah as her name, although that was her name. She just liked to be called Sally. So Sarah and Sally are the same person.
Yeah, so here's Ina's telling you this, and you're going, and this is so true. When you said you like to take a tape recorder now to these events, you really have to, because you're going to miss so much of them. And also, sometimes you'll get a name that's supposed to, you think is supposed to be Sarah. In this case, this is what I liked about that. It was Sally. And Sally really was the nickname she went by. And a lot of times, spirit or ones communicating with us will present things in a way that they're comfortable with. Or maybe even they'll do it deliberately to get you to check up. Because who's going to know that your birth mother's name, nickname, was Sally? So really, it adds more to it.
Yes, but I must, I'm sorry to correct you there. When Ina mentioned her, she did say, Sarah, that my father felt huge, great remorse for what he did to Sarah. So he used her, she used her real name. I didn't discover her name was Sally, or that her nickname was Sally, until I met her. And then she wrote me her first letter after we spoke on the phone, and she said, I'm Sally. So it wasn't, although what you say is true.
So Ina never suggested that your mom, she never said Sally has a message for you?
No.
Okay,
no,
I must have read that wrong. I could have swore there was a part in there that said,
you've got me mixed up, or her mixed up with some other person. No, she just said that my father, who was gone or on the other side, had this great remorse for Sarah. And Sarah, I knew, was my birth, that's all I knew, was my birth mother's name. And I didn't know until I met her that she liked to be called Sally. So, but that doesn't matter. It's all the same. But you're quite right, because the person who sent me to Ina had said he'd sent many people to her and had told them, he should have told me, but that some of them had taken a tape recorder with them at the time, and that when they got home, they played the sitting because they wanted to listen to it again. And this one case I remember was from people who had lost a son in a motorcycle accident or something. And they were listening to it. And after, when the tape came to an end, when the sitting came to an end, suddenly there was this message and there was the son's voice saying something to them, which, of course, wasn't there. It was a blank new a new tape that they had taken, and there was their son's voice. So I just feel sorry for people who shut off all these experiences from their lives. Yeah. We are so brainwashed that certain things can't happen, and we should be open. We shouldn't be gullible, but we should be open to experience if it is genuine.
Absolutely. You can approach it and still, you know, be a little bit of a skeptic. Even all my friends that are psychic will say that it's good to be skeptical, because you shouldn't blindly just follow anything.
That's right.
And spirit will prove it to you anyway. They will tell you things that aren't happening right now, but will probably happen down the road, or you may have to go and find out from somebody else. A good example of this being, first time I went to a medium back in 2007, 2006, this fella, and I was nervous because I'd never done it before, even though I'm very open. I'm thinking, well, what if this guy's got dark energy around him, and what if he brings that in? And it's like we have all these fears that we shouldn't even have. And so he did a nice job, and he covered himself in light, and he protected himself and everybody there. But he told me some things, and one of them was about my father. And I had to talk to my brother in order to find out, because I didn't know. And my father, he says, your father is showing you crutches. And he hurt his leg, or he broke his leg. That's what he's telling me. He broke his leg. And I said, I don't know. I don't think so. As an adult, I said, I don't recall that. Well, I'd been living down in Mississippi, and I was working at a radio station down there when he broke his leg. And when I called my brother, he goes, yeah, you don't remember that because you weren't here. You were living down in Mississippi. I said, oh. And then the medium, you know, spirit has a way of kind of joking around too. And the medium says, your father is around your son a lot. My son is, you know, he's in his 30s now. But this was a few years, this was back in 2007. And he says he likes his girlfriend, the girl he's with. And I said, yeah, we like her too. And he started describing her. And she's kind of got like dishwater blonde hair. And I said, no, that's not right. And I didn't want to, you know, be rude, because everything else was just very accurate. He got my mom right, all this stuff. And so I happened to see my son, and I asked him, you know, that same weekend, coincidentally, he came over to my house with his girlfriend. And it's funny how the universe lines things up. I said, well, here's a tape of what I listened to, but he says that you have dishwater blonde hair. And she was looked like a true blonde. She goes, oh, yeah, that's my real hair color.
Well, with women, you never know.
And so it's like, don't try to hide anything from spirit, because spirit, they're not going to try to embarrass you. They're just going to try to let you know you can't pull one over on them. And it was cool because my dad, I really feel that my dad did that deliberately so I would go and get validation. Don't you feel that as well,
Faye? Oh, yes. Oh, yes. We are given challenges. And I must say, Ina said many other things, which came true on subsequent occasions in an amazing way, as you know from reading the book, and I won't go into them. But yes, we are given validation, even if we're not. I was no longer skeptical, but it was lovely to be given that validation.
Mm. So, and I know, you know, the book is about, it's probably two or three different things, really. It's about trusting in a psychic, believing that there is some truth there, which you came to believe, and Ina, from her abilities, proved to you that she's pretty good. And then also, you know, about your adoptive mother who gave you incredible love, but also about adoption in general. And you brought up some issues where certain things are hard to acquire and find. And I understand they have to respect people's privacy, but you adopted two girls of your own.
I did.
And what I thought was so cool in the book is the story about your one daughter who you brought to the grieving grandparents. Do you want to share that? Because that is an incredible story.
Yes. My youngest daughter, life is so strange. I happen to know, I had a girlfriend when I went to, when I was about 12 or 13, younger actually, and her name was Helen, and we hadn't seen each other for years, and I'm maybe getting this backwards. Anyway, we met each other after not seeing each other for 30 years. We met on one of my trips home from England. I would go every summer to California. And she told me that she happened to know the mother, the birth mother of my youngest daughter, who was just very young then. And this all happens because we were Christian Scientists. I went to a Christian Science school, and she had married. It's too complicated. But anyway, we all were Christian Scientists, and that's how we knew. And my daughter's birth mother had also been a Christian Scientist, but I think she, like so many of the rest of us, had left the church. So I knew that Helen knew my birth daughter. She said she was with her the day she gave birth. And I thought, how extraordinary that this childhood friend should be so close to this experience. And then she wrote to me. Sometime later, I was in England. She wrote and told me that the girl who I call had died in an automobile accident. And I thought, how terrible. And I didn't know whether Susan's parents had other children or not, and that here I had their grandchild, and they would certainly want to know her or perhaps meet her. So we arranged, long story short. I wrote them. I met them on my next trip, which was just a month away, to California, and they were so thrilled to meet their granddaughter, and they never thought they would know her. And I took lots of pictures for them, and they said, we had always wished we just had a picture of her. And so I gave them the pictures, and they met her, and she kept in touch with them as long as they were alive. And it was a very healing experience, especially for the father, because Susan was very close to her father, and he had been absolutely devastated by her death. And seeing my daughter, I was so happy. He called me up the next day and said that he hadn't been able to sleep since her death, but having seen her daughter, her child, had, for the first time, he was able to sleep without seeing that awful picture that he had seen of his daughter when he had to identify her in the morgue. So it was a very healing experience for everyone, and I'm very blessed with with his granddaughter.
Well, it's just cool. You know, if we all could just get past, I don't know how to put this, but if we just get past all of this, oh, we can't talk about this, oh, we can't do that, and you just cut through that. You told your kids they were adopted. You brought them, gave them a chance to meet the people that were once part of their life. And I think a lot of it is maybe some people are insecure about that. And I can understand. I'm not here to judge, but I'm just saying, I just think the way all of that was handled was so incredible because it gave this man some closure and a chance to connect with somebody that, you know, came from his daughter.
So, but, you know, we're not, if I can just, we don't own our children. Our children are not our children. Mm-hmm. They come to us for a while to take care of, to love and protect and hope, you know, hopefully grow. But then we have to release them in the end. And so we shouldn't have this possessive attitude to children. I mean, my parents told me from the start that my brother and I were adopted. It was never an issue. Mm. And I did the same with my children. But they're not ours. They are ours in a way, but we give them back to, well, to the universe, I guess. Mm. They have their own lives to live, and well, I don't want to get into that. It gets too complicated.
Well, I think a lot of parents are protective, or maybe they don't know how to handle dealing with this. And I guess truth is just the best way to get through.
I think it's with the adoptive parent. I think the fear is, oh, dear, if they meet their birth parents, they're not going to love me anymore. Mm. They're going to want to. And sometimes perhaps this happens. I mean, not every adoptive experience is successful or happy, and certainly my relationship with my daughters has gone through some difficult times, but I don't think we can hang on to people, even adults. I mean, you can't keep someone loving you if they don't want to love you and if they want to leave.
You can if you have, like, a big basement and you've got, like, these bars set up. Kidding. I'm kidding. That's horrible. That would never happen. But yeah, you're right. We're all free spirits. And I really believe we come back time and time again. So really one of the great lessons is that we have to let go of all things in life. And we ultimately have no choice. At some point, we're going to have to do that. But I guess what I'm getting at is maybe there needs to be a change in the adoption. Did you hint around that about that a little bit in some of the rules and allow them to be more free? Or how do you feel about that?
Well, of course, open adoption does exist, and I think it's practiced a lot now, where the birth mother chooses the people she wants to give her child to, and I think that's good. I don't think there's any answer that is completely right for everybody. Open adoption, I think, is wonderful because it removes all the... a lot of children do feel a great guilt. I mean, I always felt guilt if I even thought about my birth parents. But I think that open adoption is wonderful for some people. It might not work for other people. It depends. We are all different, and it just depends on the people. So I don't know. I didn't do it that way myself because I went through a lawyer and adopted my daughters before they were born. They could have been boys. I wouldn't have known. I'm glad they weren't. I really felt more suited to adopt girls because I love to dress them up in pretty things. But I just think that it's systems work for some people and not others. But I think adoption has gone through much more openness, which is good on the whole. It's good to be open. Transparency and everything, honesty and everything. Just as with gays, I think it is so much better now for people to be able to say, I am gay. This is the kind of relationship I want. And not to have for men. Some men had to marry to sort of get ahead in life, to look as though they were fitting in with the general population when they really weren't. And that led to a lot of unhappiness mm-hmm. on both sides. And I think we must be true to who we are,
absolutely.
Whatever we are.
Absolutely. Amen to that. And I think as you and I have kind of corresponded back and forth about this, and you said, you know, there's some things out there that just don't, it doesn't look good. And then I look at, like, what you're talking about, the acceptance of gays. Look how quickly that's come forward. And I know there's been things going on behind the scenes, but look how quickly we've changed our thoughts on animals' rights, on gays, transsexual, whoever, women, even though they're still kind of being held back, I think, and put behind men in a lot of ways, we're becoming more accepting. And I just think this is the evolution that's taking place right now, is that some certainly don't get it, and they may not get it for a long time. But these things never could have happened 30 years ago. It's been like a shift in consciousness to be more accepting, more loving. A lot of people have become that way.
That's right. But it's taken many years to get here. It seems very quick now, but I think it wasn't so quick for people 50 years ago.
Probably not. But you know what? What I say also is that the attitudes have shifted. And yes, we become a more open society. But even people, here's an example. People that were staunch believers of a certain religion, people that I've known for a long time, and they always want to push it on me a little bit, and then I'll tell them what I think, which is more of a metaphysical Native American, whatever you want to call it, label it, and just that God is in all things and is love. And now I see them shifting out of their hard stance years later. And it hasn't even, and I just, what makes them do this? And I believe consciousness is shifting on the planet. And that's why what you're doing, writing a book about adoption and about Ina Twigg, all these things are more accepted now because we are opening up and becoming beings that are becoming more accepting. More and more of us are coming to the planet to allow this to happen. That's kind of where I go with all that.
Yes, I think you're right. I hope you're right.
Yeah, I hope so too. If I'm wrong, then we're in for a rough ride. It still could be a rough ride. I'm not saying it won't be. But, you know, so many psychics and mediums that I've talked to, people that I respect. And, you know, I don't just give out my respect just like that. And not that I doubt people, but it's like, you know, you go in with a little bit of, okay, I don't know if I'm completely trust this. I'm going to let this person prove it to me. And that's not meant to be a judgment. But a lot of them said, you know, since 2012, we've been going through this shift and the shift in consciousness, and the old ways are going to fall by the wayside because they don't serve us anymore. And the new ways of love and expanded consciousness and equality for everybody and everything on the planet is shifting its energy. We're shifting our energy right with it. And these are all the bumps that we're going through. And some of these things that happen are extreme. We talked about how the healthcare profession appears to be destroying people that are trying to tell us about natural health, and they will shut you down. And I've heard this for a number of years. But to me, it's part of a bigger picture that the truth is coming out, and people are willing to challenge this, even if it means their life could come to an end. And this is what I'm seeing more. I look at these people that live in foreign countries, and they're standing up to their governments, which they never would have done without. They don't have any weapons, and they're still standing up to them. And I think this is what we're going to see. More and more of us are going to say, you know what? No more. Mm-mm. We're holding you accountable. I hope that's the way we're going.
I hope so. I hope we're holding some of our government organizations accountable too in this country.
I think this election is actually going to serve in that way because we have one candidate who is speaking very frankly in Bernie Sanders. Now, I don't agree with everything, but I do like a lot of, he's just calling a lot of things as they are. And we've seen that now for two elections in a row, that there has always, there's been a third candidate that has been kind of saying, okay, wait a second, you guys, you're ignoring the big picture, the man behind the curtain over here. You're not paying attention to that. And so I think we're going in the right direction. It's a painful, bumpy road, but I think your book has something to offer for people that can, one, remember that there was a time in this country that maybe things were really good in the 20s, and then they hit that depression. And we kind of saw that, I think, in the 60s and 70s, and then we hit a bump as well. It's very similar what we're going through now, don't you think?
Yes, I suppose so. Except you know, I think back to the 50s, and to me they were, there are always problems, but even with the problems we had then, I think they were a much kinder, gentler, more civil time than we have now. I'm very disturbed by the lack of civility that has come into all of our politics now. We attack each other, we demonstrate, we march, we punch the air with our fists. We don't have to do that. We weren't meant to do that. We're supposed to have freedom of speech and then to make our laws according to a consensus. But it seems to be getting nastier and nastier, and I'm not happy about that.
No.
But I hope I won't be here to see it too much longer.
You know, all you got to do, though, is you go back in history. If you go back far enough in this country, you will find that people really slammed each other, the Lincoln debate, what they called each other. If you go back to Andrew Jackson and some of the things he did, it kind of makes some of it look mild compared to what
I don't think they weren't as vulgar.
Maybe not
time.
As vulgar.
Their speech wasn't as vulgar.
But they attacked each other and called each other all kinds of names. Nothing was when Andrew Jackson got married, as I remember the story, the woman he was married to apparently didn't go through the right ramifications, legalities to get divorced, even though she thought she did. So they just raked her up and down, the first lady. And this really is what led to her dying, because she kind of died of a broken heart when she was in the White House. And he was a bitter man over that. So it's always been with us, I think. Maybe we toned it down in the 50s, maybe because we just won World War II, people were more appreciative, maybe we did have some more respect, but there was a time in this country we weren't very cultured. I don't think we were very
that's true.
And so we've gone through ups and downs, ups and downs, up and down, ups and downs, and right now maybe we're going through it. I guess what I was comparing is that even though they don't call this a depression, I think there's a lot of similarities compared to the Great Depression. It's just that we have these other programs in place to kind of make it look like it doesn't exist. But there is a lot of that going on, and this is a lot of reason for people being unhappy. So I look back at your book talking about Fanchon and her brother and how they started things up. And then the Depression hit, and they still survived, and they did pretty well even during that. Now, one thing I wanted to mention also to you on that is you lived in Buster Keaton's house at one time?
Yes, for 7 years.
Oh, my goodness.
My mother bought it when his fortunes tanked, and he had to sell his house, which he loved, and I lived there and grew up there, really, and it was wonderful. It was a marvelous place, and, I was so fortunate. And I keep, every day I think it becomes more of a miracle to me, the life that I had. I sometimes feel that I was writing about another person's life because I can't believe that I actually lived that. But I did, and I was just very lucky.
Well, then there's also, and maybe people don't know who Buster Keaton is, but he was a legendary comedian. But also
he was as popular as Charlie Chaplin in his day.
So a name everybody should know, and this is not like to make it anything big out of it. I just think it's cool that you had these people at your house. Groucho Marx, there's a story in the book about him being at your house. What happened with that?
Oh, that was, my mother used to, my mother used to obtain films from the different studios, and every Friday night we had a projection. We were able to show films in our den, and we showed films every Friday night for friends and family. And one night Groucho Marx was there, and the film we happened to have, I don't know how many of your listeners are still familiar with it, was The Outlaw with Jane Russell. This was her introduction, and Howard Hughes, she was his protege. She was very well endowed, and he made the most of that. And she had been on billboards all over Beverly Hills and Los Angeles in this very seductive pose. Well, Groucho Marx was one of our guests that night, and he was sitting in the back row. And every time she appeared on the screen, he would make some salacious remark about her, only one of which I can remember, which I won't repeat. But I so regret that I don't know how old I was then, 20 something, or 18, I think. I just wish I could have written them down, because they were hilarious, and even my very straight-laced parents were laughing. So
I think those are just cool stories to hear, and just for the sake that it's kind of neat, because, you know, you hear about these people, and it just kind of connects it to all of it, that time period and everything like that. So it's a wonderful book. I recommend people read it, whether you want to read it about the old time Hollywood, read about an amazing woman that and having, you know, who took care of you with a really good father. Or if you want to go into the Ina Twigg, there's like several segments. Or if you want to think about the adoption, because a lot of people, don't you feel a lot of people are, maybe it's not like that anymore because adoptions might be more open, but they feel like something's missing. Like you wonder, why were you given up for adoption?
Yes. Well, I never cared because I was so fortunate. I think that the adoptive parent, and I'm talking in general terms, I think the adoptive parent feels more at ease, perhaps, with the relationship because they just take in this child. They love it as their own, and sometimes you just love it to death. But I think the child, although it would never, rarely ever talk about this to the parent, has all these inner wonderings. Why was I given up? Who were my parents? Some people care about it. Some people don't. I know adopted people who said, I never was interested or curious, and that's wonderful. But others are. It's a very delicate relationship, and I don't think there's any one rule that goes for every single situation. Each one is different. Some are happy, some aren't. It's just, I always feel sort of guilty that I had such a wonderful experience.
Well, the people I know, and I don't know a whole lot of people, but some of them maybe feel like unloved. It's really what we put on ourselves. And what I like about what you said in your book, and you have a moment, you know, with more than one with your natural mother, and they're not always so pleasant, but you find a way to make peace with it. You know, we have to accept it for what it is, and we have to let go of our expectations. Would you say that's an accurate estimate?
Yes, I had no expectations when I met my birth mother. I mean, I thought, I don't care what she is. She can be a prostitute. It doesn't matter to me. I really didn't care because I knew I had this wonderful mother who raised me and loved me. But my birth mother turned out to be a very nice lady. She'd been a secretary all her life. She was just a very ordinary sort of person. I don't think I would have been as happy growing up with her because she had a kind of jealous disposition, which fortunately I haven't inherited, and that would have been very difficult for me to live with, I'm afraid.
Do you think that things that happen to us is there some kind of grand design in all of that that takes place?
I don't know. There's so many things I don't know. I think if we have reached a point in our life when we just sort of like to tune in, I like to call it spirit. I don't like the word God. I think it has been used in too many different ways, and it's too anthropomorphic. I like to think of spirit as being just what is with us, all around us. And I think if we tune into spirit and say, guide me, show me the way to go, and I will try to listen to your voice and not mistake whenever I've done that, I've been guided. Now, I wasn't guided to be adopted because I wasn't aware. I was only a year and a half then. But I think somehow we are perhaps each here to fulfill some sort of plan. I'm not sure I know what it is, but we just try to do the best we can. And sometimes we're taken in the path we had no intention of going, which is what happened to me, and it turns out to be the one that was most important in your life.
And maybe, you know, once you get to that other place, and I've had, you know, actually a lot of psychics have told me about this, that we really do kind of plan out. I know they've talked to spirits back and forth and loved ones, and we kind of plan out what we're going to do when we get here, and we have an outline of what we want to accomplish because we come back, you know, from my understanding, several times to evolve and continue to grow and become more unconditional loving beings. Mm-hmm. And eventually, you know, we have two things going on when we're here. You have an outline of, I'm going to be this, and this is going to happen, and hopefully I'm going to expand to become this. And then the other thing is the law of attraction. So while we're here, we focus on certain things, we bring those things in. So you might have had a plan to go this direction, but thoughts brought in other things and your life took another, or you made choices that took another. Now, as far as you being a young child like that at a year and a half, I don't think you had too many thoughts about, gee, I hope I'm adopted someday. I'm thinking of putting this out there to the universe and maybe it'll happen. Or to me, it would be more like your soul said, you know what, we should experience this time, Faye. Let's go down there and see what it's like to be adopted. Because maybe in another lifetime, you experienced, I don't know, who knows what the reason would be, but it's always about love, I think. So what I see, I take away from your book is that you were able to love all the people in your life, two sets of parents, none of which were perfect, but the first, you know, the ones that took you in, the natural parents, were very loving. And perhaps your father, if you knew him, would have been that way. Your mother and you might have clashed a little bit more. But you were able to present it all in a way that it is part of what it is. It's all part of an extended family, and it's all part of what goes on. And you have to let it go.
Oh, and I was raised in a very loving family. I mean, all my relatives were loving, and I never felt like an outsider. And even to this day, I have two cousins who live not too far from me, and we just have always felt as though we are cousins. That's all. No, it's love is the bottom line. Mm-hmm. If you're loved and if you can give love, then that's, I think, what it's all about.
That's why I like talking to you, Faye. I think you're right on target, and I love the book, and I recommend it. And your website, if people want to go find that.
Yes, it's fanchonsdaughter.com. That's the that's if you want to get into the book, and you can read some of it there. But it's on the website.
And then also, of course, you have the other book. And how do they find that one as well?
Well, I think both of them, you can sort of obviously find it, Amazon. My other book is called Invisible Enemy, and it's very topical now because with the EPA regulating chemicals, mine's all about how chemicals destroyed my immune system and the alternative therapy that restored me to health. So it's rather topical.
As always, and it's only been a couple of times, but it's a great pleasure talking to you, Faye. I just feel a great connection with you, and I love your work.
Well, thank you. It's a great pleasure to be with you again, too. We are kindred souls.
Yes, we are. Thank you.